lucky sailing vessels from half a dozen European nations dispersed to every ocean. There were many motivations for these journeys: ambition, greed, national pride, religious fanaticism, prison pardons, scientific curiosity, the thirst for adventure, and the unavailability of suitable employment in Estremadura. These voyages worked much evil as well as much good, but the net result has been to bind the Earth together, to decrease provincialism, to unify the human species, and to advance powerfully our knowledge of our planet and ourselves. Emblematic of the epoch of sailing ship exploration and discovery is the revolutionary Dutch Republic of the 17th century. Having recently declared its independence from the powerful Spanish Empire, it embraced more fully than any other nation of its time the European Enlightenment. It was a rational, orderly, creative society. But because Spanish ports and vessels were closed to Dutch shipping, the economic survival of the tiny republic depended on its ability to construct, man, and deploy a great fleet of commercial sailing vessels. The Dutch East India Company, a joint governmental and private enterprise, sent ships to the far corners of the world to acquire rare commodities and resell them at a profit in Europe. Such voyages were the lifeblood of the Republic. Navigational charts and maps were classified as state secrets. Ships often embarked with sealed orders. Suddenly, the Dutch were present all over the planet. The Barents Sea in the Arctic Ocean and Tasmania in Australia are named after Dutch sea captains. These expeditions were not merely commercial exploitations, although there was plenty of that. There were powerful elements of scientific adventure and the zest for discovery of new lands, new plants and animals, new people, the pursuit of knowledge for its own sake. The Amsterdam Town Hall reflects the confident and secular self-image of 17th century Holland. It took shiploads of marble to build. Constantine Huygens, a poet and diplomat of the time, remarked that the town hall dispelled the Gothic squint and squalor. In the town hall to this day, there is a statue of Atlas supporting the heavens, festooned with constellations. Beneath is Justice, brandishing a golden sword and scales, standing between death and punishment, and treading underfoot avarice and envy, the gods of the merchants. The Dutch, whose economy was based on private profit, nevertheless understood that the unrestrained pursuit of profit posed a threat to the nation's soul. A less allegorical symbol may be found under Atlas and Justice on the floor of the town hall. It is a great inlaid map, dating from the late 17th or early 18th centuries, reaching from West Africa to the Pacific Ocean. The whole world was Holland's arena, and on this map, with disarming modesty, the Dutch omitted themselves, using only the old Latin name, Belgium, for their part of Europe. In a typical year, many ships set sail halfway around the world, down the west coast of Africa, through what they called the Ethiopian Sea, around the south coast of Africa, within the Straits of Madagascar, and on past the southern tip of India, they sailed to one major focus of their interest, the Spice Islands, present-day Indonesia. Some expeditions journeyed from there to a land named New Holland, and today called Australia. A few ventured through the Straits of Malacca, past the Philippines, to China. We know from a mid-17th century account of an embassy from the East India Company of the United Provinces of the Netherlands to the Grand Tartar, Cham, Emperor of China. The Dutch burghers, ambassadors, and sea captains stood wide-eyed in amazement, face to face with another civilization in the imperial city of Peking. We even know what gifts they brought the court. The Empress was presented with six little chests of divers' pictures, and the Emperor received two fardels of cinnamon. Never before or since has Holland been the world power it was then. A small country forced to live by its wits, its foreign policy contained a strong pacifist element. Because of its tolerance for unorthodox opinions, it was a haven for intellectuals who were refugees from censorship and thought control elsewhere in Europe, much as the United States benefited enormously in the 1930s by the exodus of intellectuals from the Nazi-dominated Europe. So 17th-century Holland was the home of the great Jewish philosopher Spinoza, whom Einstein admired, of Descartes, a pivotal figure in the history of mathematics and philosophy, and of John Locke, a political scientist who influenced a group of philosophically inclined revolutionaries named Paine, Hamilton, Adams, Franklin, and Jefferson. Never before or since has Holland been graced by such a galaxy of artists and scientists, philosophers, and mathematicians. This was the time of the master painters Rembrandt and Vermeer, and Frans Hals, of Leeuwenhoek, the inventor of the microscope, of Grotius, the founder of international law, of Willibrord Snellius, who discovered the law of the refraction of light. In the Dutch tradition of encouraging freedom of thought, the University of Leiden offered a professorship to an Italian scientist named Galileo, who had been forced by the Catholic Church under threat of torture to recant his heretical view that the earth moved about the sun and not vice versa. Galileo had close ties with Holland, and his first astronomical telescope was an improvement of a spyglass of Dutch design. With it, he discovered sunspots, the phases of Venus, the craters of the moon, and the four large moons of Jupiter now called after him, the Galilean satellites. Galileo's own description of his ecclesiastical travails is contained in a letter he wrote in the year 1615 to the Grand Duchess Christina. Some years ago, as your Serene Highness well knows, I discovered in the heavens many things that had not been seen before our own age. The novelty of these things, as well as some consequences which followed from them in contradiction to the physical notions commonly held among academic philosophers, stirred up against me no small number of professors, many of them ecclesiastics, as if I had placed these things in the sky with my own hands in order to upset nature and overturn the sciences. They seem to forget that the increase of known truths stimulates the investigation, establishment, and growth of the arts. The courage of Galileo and Kepler in promoting the heliocentric hypothesis was not evident in the actions of others, even those residing in less fanatically doctrinal parts of Europe. For example, in a letter dated April 1634, René Descartes, then living in Holland, wrote, "Doubtless you know that Galileo was recently censured by the inquisitors of the faith, and that his views about the movement of the earth were condemned as heretical. I must tell you that all the things I explained in my treatise, which included the doctrine of the movement of the earth, were so interdependent that it is enough to discover that one of them is false to know that all the arguments I was using are unsound. Though I thought they were based on very certain and evident proofs, I would not wish for anything in the world to maintain them against the authority of the Church. I desire to live in peace and to continue the life I have begun under the motto, 'To live well, you must live unseen.'" The connection between Holland as an exploratory power and Holland as an intellectual and cultural center was very strong. The improvement of sailing ships encouraged technology of all kinds. People enjoyed working with their hands. Inventions were prized. Technological advance required the freest possible pursuit of knowledge, so Holland became the leading publisher and bookseller in Europe, translating works written in other languages and permitting the publication of works prescribed elsewhere. Adventures into exotic lands and encounters with strange societies shook complacency, challenged thinkers to reconsider the prevailing wisdom, and showed that ideas that had been accepted for thousands of years, for example, on geography, were fundamentally in error. In a time when kings and emperors ruled much of the world, the Dutch Republic was governed more than any other nation by the people. The openness of the society and its encouragement of the life of the mind, its material well-being, and its commitment to the exploration and utilization of new worlds generated a joyful confidence in the human enterprise. This exploratory tradition may account for the fact that Holland has, to this day, produced far more than its per capita share of distinguished astronomers, among them Gerard Peter Kuiper, who, in the 1940s and 1950s, was the world's only full-time planetary astrophysicist. The subject was then considered by most professional astronomers to be at least slightly disreputable, tainted with Lowellian excesses. I am grateful to have been Kuiper's student. In Italy, Galileo had announced other worlds, and Giordano Bruno had speculated on other life forms. For this, they had been made to suffer brutally. But in Holland, the astronomer Christian Huygens, who believed in both, was showered with honors. His father was Constantijn Huygens, a master diplomat of the age, a litterateur, poet, composer, musician, close friend, and translator of the English poet John Donne, and the head of an archetypical great family. Constantijn admired the painter Rubens and discovered a young artist named Rembrandt van Rijn, in several of whose works he subsequently appears. After their first meeting, Descartes wrote of him, "I could not believe that a single mind could occupy itself with so many things and equip itself so well in all of them." The Huygens home was filled with goods from all over the world. Distinguished thinkers from other nations were frequent guests. Growing up in this environment, the young Christian Huygens became simultaneously adept in languages, drawing, law, science, engineering, mathematics, and music. His interests and allegiances were broad. "The world is my country," he said. "Science, my religion." Light was a motif of the age, the symbolic enlightenment of freedom of thought and religion, of geographical discovery, the light that permeated the paintings of the time, particularly the exquisite work of Vermeer, and light as an object of scientific inquiry, as in Schnell's study of refraction, Leeuwenhoek's invention of the microscope, and Huygens' own wave theory of light. These were all connected activities, and their practitioners mingled freely. Vermeer's interiors are characteristically filled with nautical artifacts and wall maps. Microscopes were drawing room curiosities. Leeuwenhoek was the executor of Vermeer's estate and a frequent visitor at the Huygens home in Hofwijk. Leeuwenhoek's microscope evolved from the magnifying glasses employed by drapers to examine the quality of cloth. With it, he discovered a universe in a drop of water. The microbes, which he described as animalcules, and thought cute. Huygens had contributed to the design of the first microscopes and himself made many discoveries with them. Leeuwenhoek and Huygens were among the first people ever to see human sperm cells, a prerequisite for understanding human reproduction. To explain how microorganisms slowly develop in water previously sterilized by boiling, Huygens proposed that they were small enough to float through the air and reproduced on alighting in water. Thus, he established an alternative to spontaneous generation, the notion that life could arise in fermenting grape juice or rotting meat entirely independent of pre-existing life. It was not until the time of Louis Pasteur, two centuries later, that Huygens' speculation was proved correct. The Viking search for life on Mars can be traced in more ways than one back to Leeuwenhoek and Huygens. They are also the grandfathers of the germ theory of disease, and therefore of much of modern medicine. But they had no practical motives in mind. They were merely tinkering in a technological society. The microscope and telescope, both developed in early 17th century Holland, represent an extension of human vision to the realms of the very small and the very large. Our observations of atoms and galaxies were launched in this time and place. Christian Huygens loved to grind and polish lenses for astronomical telescopes and constructed one 5 meters long. His discoveries with a telescope would by themselves have ensured his place in the history of human accomplishment. In the footsteps of Eratosthenes, he was the first person to measure the size of another planet. He was also the first to speculate that Venus is completely covered with clouds, the first to draw a surface feature on the planet Mars, a vast, dark, windswept slope called Syrtis Major, and by observing the appearance and disappearance of such features as the planet rotated, the first to determine that the Martian day was, like ours, roughly 24 hours long. He was the first to recognize that Saturn was surrounded by a system of rings which nowhere touches the planet. And he was the discoverer of Titan, the largest moon of Saturn, and, as we now know, the largest moon in the solar system, a world of extraordinary interest and promise. Most of these discoveries he made in his 20s. He also thought astrology was nonsense. Huygens did much more. A key problem for marine navigation in this age was the determination of a longitude. Latitude could easily be determined by the stars. The further south you were, the more southern constellations you could see. But longitude required precise timekeeping. An accurate shipboard clock would tell the time in your home port. The rising and setting of the sun and stars would specify the local shipboard time, and the difference between the two would yield your longitude. Huygens invented the pendulum clock. Its principle had been discovered earlier by Galileo, which was then employed, although not fully successfully, to calculate position in the midst of the great ocean. His efforts introduced an unprecedented accuracy in astronomical and other nautical clocks. He invented the spiral balance spring, still used in some watches today, made fundamental contributions to mechanics, for example, the calculation of centrifugal force, and from a study of the game of dice to the theory of probability. He improved the air pump, which was later to revolutionize the mining industry, and the magic lantern, the ancestor of the slide projector. He also invented something called the gunpowder engine, which influenced the development of another machine, the steam engine. Huygens was delighted that the Copernican view of the Earth as a planet in motion around the sun was widely accepted even by the ordinary people in Holland. Indeed, he said, Copernicus was acknowledged by all astronomers except those who were a bit slow-witted or under the superstitions imposed by merely human authority. In the Middle Ages, Christian philosophers were fond of arguing that since the heavens circle the earth once every day, they can hardly be infinite in extent, and therefore an infinite number of worlds, or even a large number of them, or even one other of them, is impossible. The discovery that the earth is turning rather than the sky moving had important implications for the uniqueness of the earth and the possibility of life elsewhere. Copernicus held that not just the solar system, but the entire universe was heliocentric, and Kepler denied that the stars have planetary systems. The first person to make explicit the idea of a large, indeed an infinite, number of other worlds in orbit about other suns seems to have been Giordano Bruno. But others thought that the plurality of worlds followed immediately from the ideas of Copernicus and Kepler and found themselves aghast. In the early 17th century, Robert Merton contended that the heliocentric hypothesis implied a multitude of other planetary systems, and that this was an argument of the sort called reductio ad absurdum, demonstrating the error of the initial assumption. He wrote in an argument which may once have seemed withering, "For if the firmament be of such incomparable bigness as these Copernican giants will have it, so vast and full of innumerable stars, as being infinite in extent, why may we not suppose those infinite stars visible in the firmament to be so many suns with particular fixed centers to have likewise their subordinate planets, as the sun hath his, dancing still around him? And so, in consequence, there are infinite habitable worlds. What hinders? These and such like insolent and bold attempts, prodigious paradoxes, inferences, must needs follow, if it once be granted which Kepler and others maintain of the Earth's motion." But the Earth does move. Merton, if he lived today, would be obliged to deduce infinite habitable worlds. Huygens did not shrink from this conclusion. He embraced it gladly. Across the sea of space, the stars are other suns. By analogy with our solar system, Huygens reasoned that those stars should have their own planetary systems and that many of these planets might be inhabited. Should we allow the planets nothing but vast deserts and deprive them of all those creatures that more plainly bespeak their divine architect? We should sink them below the earth in beauty and dignity, a thing very unreasonable. A few others had held similar opinions. In his Harmonici Mundi, Kepler remarked it was Tycho Brahe's opinion concerning that bare wilderness of globes that it does not exist fruitlessly, but is filled with inhabitants. These ideas were set forth in an extraordinary book bearing the triumphant title The Celestial Worlds Discovered, Conjectures Concerning the Inhabitants, Plants, and Productions of the Worlds in the Planets. Composed shortly before Huygens died in 1690, the work was admired by many, including Tsar Peter the Great, who made it the first product of Western science to be published in Russia. The book is in large part about the nature or environments of the planets. Among the figures in the finely rendered first edition is one in which we see to scale the Sun and the giant planets Jupiter and Saturn. They are comparatively rather small. There is also an etching of Saturn next to the Earth. Our planet is a tiny circle. By and large, Huygens imagined the environments and inhabitants of other planets to be rather like those of 17th century Earth. He conceived of planetarians whose whole bodies, and every part of them, may be quite distinct and different from ours. 'Tis a very ridiculous opinion that it is impossible a rational soul should dwell in any other shape than ours. You could be smart, he was saying, even if you looked peculiar. But he then went on to argue that they would not look very peculiar, that they must have hands and feet and walk upright, that they would have writing and geometry, and that Jupiter has its four Galilean satellites to provide a navigational aid for the sailors in the Jovian oceans. Huygens was, of course, a citizen of his time. Who of us is not? He claimed science as his religion and then argued that the planets must be inhabited because otherwise, God had made worlds for nothing. Because he lived before Darwin, his speculations about extraterrestrial life are innocent of the evolutionary perspective. But he was able to develop on observational grounds something akin to the modern cosmic perspective. What a wonderful and amazing scheme we have here on the magnificent vastness of the universe. So many suns, so many earths, and every one of them stocked with so many herbs, trees, and animals, adorned with so many seas and mountains. And how must our wonder and admiration be increased when we consider the prodigious distance and multitude of the stars? The Voyager spacecraft are the lineal descendants of those sailing ship voyages of exploration and of the scientific and speculative tradition of Christian Huygens. The Voyagers are caravels bound for the stars and on the way exploring those worlds that Huygens knew and loved so well. One of the main commodities returned on those voyages of centuries ago were travelers' tales, stories of alien lands and exotic creatures that evoked our sense of wonder and stimulated future exploration. There had been accounts of mountains that reached the sky, of dragons and sea monsters, of everyday eating utensils made of gold, of a beast with an arm for a nose, of people who thought the doctrinal disputes among Protestants, Catholics, Jews, and Muslims to be silly, of a black stone that burned, of headless humans with mouths in their chests, of sheep that grew on trees. Some of these stories were true, some were lies. Others had a kernel of truth, misunderstood or exaggerated by the explorers or their informants. In the hands of Voltaire, say, or Jonathan Swift, these accounts stimulated a new perspective on European society, forcing a reconsideration of that insular world. Modern voyagers also return travelers' tales, tales of a world shattered like a crystal sphere, a globe where the ground is covered pole to pole with what looks like a network of cobwebs, tiny moons shaped like potatoes, a world with an underground ocean, a land that smells of rotten eggs and looks like a pizza pie, with lakes of molten sulfur and volcanic eruptions ejecting smoke directly into space, a planet called Jupiter that dwarfs our own, so large that 1,000 Earths would fit within it. The Galilean satellites of Jupiter are each almost as big as the planet Mercury. We can measure their sizes and masses and so calculate their density, which tells us something about the composition of their interiors. We find that the inner two, Io and Europa, have a density as high as rock. The outer two, Ganymede and Callisto, have a much lower density, halfway between rock and ice. But the mixture of ice and rocks within these outer moons must contain, as do rocks on Earth, traces of radioactive minerals, which heat their surroundings. There is no effective way for this heat, accumulated over billions of years, to reach the surface and be lost to space, and the radioactivity inside Ganymede and Callisto must therefore melt their icy interiors. We anticipate underground oceans of slush and water in these moons. A hint, before we have ever seen the surfaces of the Galilean satellites close up, that they may be very different one from another. When we do look closely through the eyes of Voyager, this prediction is confirmed. They do not resemble each other. They are different from any worlds we have ever seen before. The Voyager 2 spacecraft will never return to Earth, but its scientific findings, its epic discoveries, its travelers' tales do return. Take July 9, 1979, for instance. At 8:04 Pacific Standard Time on this morning, the first pictures of a new world called Europa, after an old one, were received on Earth. How does a picture from the outer solar system get to us? Sunlight shines on Europa in its orbit around Jupiter and is reflected back to space, where some of it strikes the phosphors of the Voyager television cameras, generating an image. The image is read by the Voyager computers, radioed back across the immense intervening distance of 500 million kilometers to a radio telescope, a ground station on the Earth. There is one in Spain, one in the Mojave Desert of Southern California, and one in Australia. On that July morning in 1979, it was the one in Australia that was pointed toward Jupiter and Europa. It then passes the information via a communications satellite in Earth orbit to Southern California, where it is transmitted by a set of microwave relay towers to a computer at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory where it is processed. The picture is fundamentally like a newspaper wire photo, made of perhaps a million individual dots, each a different shade of gray, so fine and close together that at a distance, the constituent dots are invisible. We see only their cumulative effect. The information from the spacecraft specifies how bright or dark each dot is to be. After processing, the dots are then stored on a magnetic disk, something like a phonograph record. There are some 18,000 photographs taken in the Jupiter system by Voyager 2 that are stored on such magnetic disks, and an equivalent number for Voyager 1. Finally, the end product of this remarkable set of links and relays is a thin piece of glossy paper, in this case, showing the wonders of Europa, recorded, processed, and examined for the first time in human history on July 9, 1979. What we saw on such pictures was absolutely astonishing. Voyager 1 obtained excellent imagery of the other three Galilean satellites of Jupiter, but not Europa. It was left for Voyager 2 to acquire the first close-up pictures of Europa, where we see things that are only a few kilometers across. At first glance, the place looks like nothing so much as the canal network that Percival Lowell imagined to adorn Mars, and that, we now know from space vehicle exploration, does not exist at all. We see, on Europa, an amazing intricate network of intersecting straight and curved lines. Are they ridges, that is, raised? Are they troughs, that is, depressed? How are they made? Are they part of a global tectonic system produced perhaps by fracturing of an expanding or contracting planet? Are they connected with plate tectonics on the Earth? What light do they shed on the other satellites of the Jovian system? At the moment of discovery, the vaunted technology has produced something astonishing. But it remains for another device, the human brain, to figure it out. Europa turns out to be as smooth as a billiard ball despite the network of lineations. The absence of impact craters may be due to the heating and flow of surface ice upon impact. The lines are grooves or cracks, their origin still being debated long after the mission. If the Voyager missions were manned, the captain would keep a ship's log, and the log, a combination of the events of Voyagers 1 and 2, might read something like this. Day 1. After much concern about provisions and instruments which seemed to be malfunctioning, we successfully lifted off from Cape Canaveral on our long journey to the planets and the stars. Day 2. A problem in the deployment of the boom that supports the science scan platform. If the problem is not solved, we will lose most of our pictures and other scientific data. Day 13. We have looked back and taken the first photograph ever obtained of the Earth and Moon as worlds together in space. A pretty pair. Day 150. Engines fired nominally for a mid-course trajectory correction. Day 170. Routine housekeeping functions. An uneventful few months. Day 185. Successful calibration images taken of Jupiter. Day 207. Boom problem solved, but failure of main radio transmitter. We have moved to backup transmitter. If it fails, no one on Earth will ever hear from us again. Day 215. We cross the orbit of Mars. That planet itself is on the other side of the sun. Day 295. We enter the asteroid belt. There are many large tumbling boulders here, the shoals and reefs of space. Most of them are uncharted. Lookouts posted. We hope to avoid a collision. Day 475. We safely emerge from the main asteroid belt, happy to have survived. Day 570. Jupiter is becoming prominent in the sky. We can now make out finer detail on it than the largest telescopes on Earth have ever obtained. Day 615. The colossal weather systems and changing clouds of Jupiter spinning in space before us have us hypnotized. The planet is immense. It is more than twice as massive as all the other planets put together. There are no mountains, valleys, volcanoes, rivers, no boundaries between land and air, just a vast ocean of dense gas and floating clouds. A world without a surface. Everything we can see on Jupiter is floating in its sky. Day 630. The weather on Jupiter continues to be spectacular. This ponderous world spins on its axis in less than 10 hours. Its atmospheric motions are driven by the rapid rotation, by sunlight, and by the heat bubbling and welling up from its interior. Day 640. The cloud patterns are distinctive and gorgeous. They remind us a little of Van Gogh's Starry Night, or works by William Blake or Edvard Munch. But only a little. No artist ever painted like this because none of them ever left our planet. No painter trapped on Earth ever imagined a world so strange and lovely. We observe the multicolored belts and bands of Jupiter close up. The white bands are thought to be high clouds, probably ammonia crystals. The brownish-colored belts, deeper and hotter places where the atmosphere is sinking. The blue places are apparently deep holes in the overlying clouds through which we see clear sky. We do not know the reason for the reddish-brown color of Jupiter. Perhaps it is due to the chemistry of phosphorus or sulfur. Perhaps it is due to complex, brightly colored organic molecules produced when ultraviolet light from the sun breaks down the methane, ammonia, and water in the Jovian atmosphere, and the molecular fragments recombine. In that case, the colors of Jupiter speak to us of chemical events that 4 billion years ago, back on Earth, led to the origin of life. Day 647. The Great Red Spot. A great column of gas reaching high above the adjacent clouds, so large that it could hold half a dozen Earths. Perhaps it is red because it is carrying up to view the complex molecules produced or concentrated at greater depth. It may be a great storm system, a million years old. Day 650. Encounter, a day of wonders. We successfully negotiate the treacherous radiation belts of Jupiter with only one instrument, the photopolarimeter, damaged. We accomplish the ring plane crossing and suffer no collisions with the particles and boulders of the newly discovered rings of Jupiter. And wonderful images of Amalthea, a tiny red oblong world that lives in the heart of the radiation belt, of multicolored Io, of the linear markings on Europa, the cobwebby features of Ganymede, the great multi-ringed basin on Callisto. We round Callisto and pass the orbit of Jupiter 13, the outermost of the planet's known moons. We are outward bound. Day 662. Our particle and field detectors indicate that we have left the Jovian radiation belts. The planet's gravity has boosted our speed. We are free of Jupiter at last and sail again the sea of space. Day 874. A loss of the ship's lock on the star Canopus, in the lore of constellations the rudder of a sailing vessel. It is our rudder, too, essential for the ship's orientation in the dark of space to find our way through this unexplored part of the cosmic ocean. Canopus lock reacquired. The optical sensors seem to have mistaken Alpha and Beta Centauri for Canopus. Next port of call, 2 years hence, the Saturn system. Of all the traveler's tales returned by Voyager, my favorites concern the discoveries made on the innermost Galilean satellite, Io. Before Voyager, we were aware of something strange about Io. We could resolve few features on its surface, but we knew it was red, extremely red, redder than Mars, perhaps the reddest object in the solar system. Over a period of years, something seemed to be changing on it, in infrared light, and perhaps in its radar reflection properties. We also know that partially surrounding Jupiter in the orbital position of Io was a great donut-shaped tube of atoms, sulfur and sodium and potassium, material somehow lost from Io. When Voyager approached this giant moon, we found a strange multicolored surface unlike any other in the solar system. Io is near the asteroid belt. It must have been thoroughly pummeled throughout its history by falling boulders. Impact craters must have been made, yet there were none to be seen. Accordingly, there had to be some process on Io that was extremely efficient in rubbing craters out or filling them in. The process could not be atmospheric since Io's atmosphere has mostly escaped to space because of its low gravity. It could not be running water. Io's surface is far too cold. There were a few places that resembled the summits of volcanoes, but it was hard to be sure. Linda Morabito, a member of the Voyager navigation team responsible for keeping Voyager precisely on its trajectory, was routinely ordering a computer to enhance an image of the edge of Io to bring out the stars behind it. To her astonishment, she saw a bright plume standing off in the darkness from the satellite's surface, and soon determined that the plume was in exactly the position of one of the suspected volcanoes. Voyager had discovered the first active volcano beyond the Earth. We know now of 9 large volcanoes spewing out gas and debris and hundreds, perhaps thousands, of extinct volcanoes on Io. The debris, rolling and flowing down the sides of the volcanic mountains, arching in great jets over the polychrome landscape, is more than enough to cover the impact craters. We are looking at a fresh planetary landscape, a surface newly hatched. How Galileo and Huygens would have marveled. The volcanoes of Io were predicted before they were discovered by Stanton Peale and his co-workers, who calculated the tides that would be raised in the solid interior of Io by the combined pulls of the nearby moon Europa and the giant planet Jupiter. They found that the rocks inside Io should have been melted not by radioactivity, but by tides, that much of the interior of Io should be liquid. It now seems likely that the volcanoes of Io are tapping an underground ocean of liquid sulfur, melted and concentrated near the surface. When solid sulfur is heated a little past the normal boiling point of water, to about 115 degrees centigrade, it melts and changes color. The higher the temperature, the deeper the color. If the molten sulfur is quickly cooled, it retains its color. The pattern of colors that we see on Io resembles closely what we would expect if rivers and torrents and sheets of molten sulfur were pouring out of the mouths of the volcanoes. Black sulfur, the hottest, near the top of the volcano, red and orange, including the rivers nearby, and great plains covered by yellow sulfur at a greater remove. The surface of Io is changing on a time scale of months. Maps will have to be issued regularly, like weather reports on Earth. Those future explorers on Io will have to keep their wits about them. The very thin and tenuous atmosphere of Io was found by Voyager to be composed mainly of sulfur dioxide. But this thin atmosphere can serve a useful purpose, because it may be just thick enough to protect the surface from the intense charged particles in the Jupiter radiation belt in which Io is embedded. At night, the temperature drops so low that the sulfur dioxide should condense out as a kind of white frost. The charged particles would then immolate the surface, and it would probably be wise to spend the nights just slightly underground. The great volcanic plumes of Io reach so high that they are close to injecting their atoms directly into the space around Jupiter. The volcanoes are the probable source of the great donut-shaped ring of atoms that surrounds Jupiter in the position of Io's orbit. These atoms, gradually spiraling in toward Jupiter, should coat the inner moon Amalthea and may be responsible for its reddish coloration. It is even possible that the material outgassed from Io contributes, after many collisions and condensations, to the ring system of Jupiter. A substantial human presence on Jupiter itself is much more difficult to imagine, although I suppose great balloon cities permanently floating in its atmosphere are a technological possibility for the remote future. As seen from the near sides of Io, or Europa, that immense and variable world fills much of the sky, hanging aloft, never to rise or set, because almost every satellite in the solar system keeps a constant face to its planet, as the moon does to the Earth. Jupiter will be a source of continuing provocation and excitement for the future human explorers of the Jovian moons. As the solar system condensed out of interstellar gas and dust, Jupiter acquired most of the matter that was not ejected into interstellar space and did not fall inward to form the sun. Had Jupiter been several dozen times more massive, the matter in its interior would have undergone thermonuclear reactions, and Jupiter would have begun to shine by its own light. The largest planet is a star that failed. Even so, its interior temperatures are sufficiently high that it gives off about twice as much energy as it receives from the sun. In the infrared part of the spectrum, it might even be correct to consider Jupiter a star. Had it become a star in visible light, we would today inhabit a binary or double star system with two suns in our sky, and the nights would come more rarely, a commonplace, I believe, in countless solar systems throughout the Milky Way galaxy. We would doubtless think the circumstances natural and lovely. Deep below the clouds of Jupiter, the weight of the overlying layers of atmosphere produces pressures much higher than any found on Earth, pressures so great that electrons are squeezed off hydrogen atoms, producing a remarkable substance, liquid metallic hydrogen, a physical state that has never been achieved on Earth. There is some hope that metallic hydrogen is a superconductor at moderate temperatures. If it could be manufactured on Earth, it would work a revolution in electronics. In the interior of Jupiter, where the pressures are about 3 million times the atmospheric pressure at the surface of the Earth, there is almost nothing but a great dark sloshing ocean of metallic hydrogen. But at the very core of Jupiter, there may be a lump of rock and iron an Earth-like world in a pressure vise hidden forever at the center of the largest planet. The electrical currents in the liquid metal interior of Jupiter may be the source of the planet's enormous magnetic field, the largest in the solar system, and of its associated belt of trapped electrons and protons. These charged particles are ejected from the Sun in the solar wind and captured and accelerated by Jupiter's magnetic field. Vast numbers of them are trapped far above the clouds and are condemned to bounce from pole to pole until, by chance, they encounter some high-altitude atmospheric molecule and are removed from the radiation belt. Io moves in an orbit so close to Jupiter that it plows through the midst of this intense radiation, creating cascades of charged particles, which in turn generate violent bursts of radio energy. They may also influence eruptive processes on the surface of Io. It is possible to predict radio bursts from Jupiter with better reliability than weather forecasts on Earth by computing the position of Io. That Jupiter is a source of radio emission was discovered accidentally in the 1950s, the early days of radio astronomy. Two young Americans, Bernard Burke and Kenneth Franklin, were examining the sky with a newly constructed, and for that time, very sensitive, radio telescope. They were searching the cosmic radio background, that is, radio sources far beyond our solar system. To their surprise, they found an intense and previously unreported source that seemed to correspond to no prominent star, nebula, or galaxy. What is more, it gradually moved with respect to the distant stars, much faster than any remote object could. After finding no likely explanation of all this in their charts of the distant cosmos, they one day stepped outside the observatory and looked up at the sky with the naked eye to see if anything interesting happened to be there. Bemusedly, they noted an exceptionally bright object in the right place, which they soon identified as the planet Jupiter. This accidental discovery is, incidentally, entirely typical of the history of science. Every evening before Voyager 1's encounter with Jupiter, I could see that giant planet twinkling in the sky, a sight our ancestors have enjoyed and wondered at for a million years. And on the evening of encounter, on my way to study the Voyager data arriving at JPL, I thought that Jupiter would never be the same, never again just a point of light in the night sky, but would forever after be a place to be explored and known. Jupiter and its moons are a kind of miniature solar system, an exquisite world with much to teach us. In composition, and in many other respects, Saturn is similar to Jupiter, although smaller. Rotating once every 10 hours, it exhibits colorful equatorial banding, which is, however, not so prominent as Jupiter's. It has a weaker magnetic field and radiation belt than Jupiter, and a more spectacular set of circumplanetary rings. And it is also surrounded by a dozen or more satellites. The most interesting of the moons of Saturn seems to be Titan, the largest moon in the solar system and the only one with a substantial atmosphere. Prior to the encounter of Voyager 1 with Titan in November 1980, our information about Titan was scanty and tantalizing. The only gas known unambiguously to be present was methane, CH4, discovered by G.P. Kuiper. Ultraviolet light from the sun converts methane to more complex hydrocarbon molecules and hydrogen gas. The hydrocarbons should remain on Titan, covering the surface with a brownish, tarry, organic sludge, something like that produced in experiments on the origin of life on Earth. The lightweight hydrogen gas should, because of Titan's low gravity, rapidly escape to space by a violent process known as blow-off, which should carry the methane and other atmospheric constituents with it. But Titan has an atmospheric pressure at least as great as that of the planet Mars. Blow-off does not seem to be happening. Perhaps there is some major and as yet undiscovered atmospheric constituent, nitrogen, for example, which keeps the average molecular weight of the atmosphere high and prevents blow-off. Or perhaps blow-off is happening, but the gases lost to space are being replenished by others released from the satellite's interior. The bulk density of Titan is so low that there must be a vast supply of water and other ices, probably including methane, which are at unknown rates being released to the surface by internal heating. When we examine Titan through the telescope, we see a barely perceptible reddish disk. Some observers have reported variable white clouds above that disk, most likely clouds of methane crystals. But what is responsible for the reddish coloration? Most students of Titan agree that complex organic molecules are the most likely explanation. The surface temperature and atmospheric thickness are still under debate. There have been some hints of an enhanced surface temperature due to an atmospheric greenhouse effect. With abundant organic molecules on its surface and in its atmosphere, Titan is a remarkable and unique denizen of the solar system. The history of our past voyages of discovery suggests that Voyager and other spacecraft reconnaissance missions will revolutionize our knowledge of this place. Through a break in the clouds of Titan, you might glimpse Saturn and its rings, their pale yellow color diffused by the intervening atmosphere. Because the Saturn system is 10 times farther from the Sun than is the Earth, the sunshine on Titan is only 1% as intense as we are accustomed to, and the temperatures should be far below the freezing point of water, even with a sizable atmospheric greenhouse effect. But with abundant organic matter, sunlight, and perhaps volcanic hotspots, the possibility of life on Titan cannot be readily dismissed. In that very different environment, it would, of course, have to be very different from life on Earth. There is no strong evidence either for or against life on Titan. It is merely possible. We are unlikely to determine the answer to this question without landing instrumented space vehicles on the Titanian surface. To examine the individual particles composing the rings of Saturn, we must approach them closely, for the particles are small. Snowballs and ice chips and tiny tumbling bonsai glaciers a meter or so across. We know they are composed of water ice because the spectral properties of sunlight reflected off the rings match those of ice in the laboratory measurements. To approach the particles in a space vehicle, we must slow down so that we move along with them as they circle Saturn at some 45,000 miles per hour. That is, we must be in orbit around Saturn ourselves, moving at the same speed as the particles. Only then will we be able to see them individually and not as smears or streaks. Why is there not a single large satellite instead of a ring system around Saturn? The closer a ring particle is to Saturn, the faster its orbital speed, the faster it is falling around the planet, Kepler's third law. The inner particles are streaming past the outer ones. The passing lane, as we see it, is always to the left. Although the whole assemblage is tearing around the planet itself at some 20 kilometers per second, the relative speed of two adjacent particles is very low, only some few centimeters per minute. Because of this relative motion, the particles can never stick together by their mutual gravity. As soon as they try, their slightly different orbital speeds pull them apart. If the ring were not so close to Saturn, this effect would not be so strong and the particles could accrete, making small snowballs and eventually growing into satellites. So it is probably no coincidence that outside the rings of Saturn, there is a system of satellites varying in size from a few hundred kilometers across to Titan, a giant moon nearly as large as the planet Mars. The matter in all the satellites and the planets themselves may have been originally distributed in the form of rings, which condensed and accumulated to form the present moons and planets. For Saturn, as for Jupiter, the magnetic field captures and accelerates the charged particles of the solar wind. When a charged particle bounces from one magnetic pole to the other, it must cross the equatorial plane of Saturn. If there is a ring particle in the way, the proton or electron is absorbed by this small snowball. As a result, for both planets, the rings clear out the radiation belts, which exist only interior and exterior to the particle rings. A close moon of Jupiter or Saturn will likewise gobble up radiation belt particles. And in fact, one of the new moons of Saturn was discovered in just this way. Pioneer 11 found an unexpected gap in the radiation belts caused by the sweeping up of charged particles by a previously unknown moon. The solar wind trickles into the outer solar system far beyond the orbit of Saturn. When Voyager reaches Uranus and the orbits of Neptune and Pluto, if the instruments are still functioning, they will almost certainly sense its presence, the wind between the worlds, the top of the sun's atmosphere blown outward toward the realm of the stars. Some two or three times farther from the sun than Pluto is, the pressure of the interstellar protons and electrons becomes greater than the minuscule pressure there exerted by the solar wind. That place, called the heliopause, is one definition of the outer boundary of the empire of the sun. But the Voyager spacecraft will plunge on, penetrating the heliopause sometime in the middle of the 21st century, skimming through the ocean of space, never to enter another solar system, destined to wander through eternity, far from the stellar islands, and to complete its first circumnavigation of the massive center of the Milky Way a few hundred million years from now. We have embarked on epic voyages. Chapter 7, The Backbone of Night. I would rather understand one cause than be king of Persia. Democritus of Abdera. If a faithful account was rendered of man's ideas upon divinity, he would be obliged to acknowledge that for the most part, the word gods has been used to express the concealed, remote, unknown causes of the effects he witnessed, that he applies this term when the spring of the natural, the source of known causes, ceases to be visible. As soon as he loses the thread of these causes, or as soon as his mind can no longer follow the chain, he solves the difficulty, terminates his research by ascribing it to his gods. When, therefore, he ascribes to his gods the production of some phenomenon, does he, in fact, do anything more than substitute for the darkness of his own mind a sound to which he has been accustomed to listen with reverential awe? Paul Heinrich Dietrich Baron von Holbach, Systeme de la Nature, London, 1770. When I was little, I lived in the Bensonhurst section of Brooklyn in the city of New York. I knew my immediate neighborhood intimately. Every apartment building, pigeon coop, backyard, front stoop, empty lot, elm tree, ornamental railing, coal chute, and wall for playing Chinese handball, among which the brick exterior of a theater called the Lowe's Stillwell was of superior quality. I knew where many people lived: Bruno and Dino, Ronald and Harvey, Sandy, Bernie, Danny, Jackie, and Myra. But more than a few blocks away, north of the raucous automobile traffic and elevated railway on 86th Street, was a strange, unknown territory, off limits to my wanderings. It could have been Mars, for all I knew. Even with an early bedtime, in winter you could sometimes see the stars. I would look at them, twinkling and remote, and wonder what they were. I would ask older children and adults, who would only reply, "They're lights in the sky, kid." I could see they were lights in the sky, but what were they? Just small hovering lamps? Whatever for? I felt a kind of sorrow for them, a commonplace whose strangeness remained somehow hidden from my incurious fellows. There had to be some deeper answer. As soon as I was old enough, my parents gave me my first library card. I think the library was on 85th Street, an alien land. Immediately, I asked the librarian for something on stars. She returned with a picture book displaying portraits of men and women with names like Clark Gable and Jean Harlow. I complained, and for some reason, then obscure to me, she smiled and found another book, the right kind of book. I opened it breathlessly and read until I found it. The book said something astonishing. A very big thought. It said that the stars were suns, only very far away. The sun was a star, but close up. Imagine that you took the sun and moved it so far away that it was just a tiny twinkling point of light. How far away would you have to move it? I was innocent of the notion of angular size. I was